about secular humanism, and my guests are Dr. Paul Kurtz, the man who drafted the Humanist Manifesto II and a secular humanist declaration. He's also the editor of the main secular humanist magazine in America called The Free Inquiry, and he's also professor of philosophy at the State University of New York at Buffalo. Also, Dr. Norman Geisler from Dallas Theological Seminary, an Orthodox Christian, who has authored many books on philosophy and theology. Gentlemen, we're glad that you're here tonight. Is there any rational justification for being a humanist, is one of the questions we want to ask Paul. And Dr. Geisler, is it more or less rational for a person to hold to biblical Christian beliefs? And Paul, I'd like to start in a different area tonight, and that would be of looking at a quick definition here of a secular humanist. Okay, now instead of giving the Humanist Manifesto 1 and 2 here, let me just give you a brief one, because we're going to go through different points of the manifestos here. Sir Julian Huxley, okay, gave us a brief definition. He says, "I use the word humanist to mean someone who believes that man is just as much a natural phenomenon as an animal or a plant, that his body, mind, and soul were not supernaturally created, but are products of evolution, and that he is not under the control or guidance of any supernatural being or beings, but has to rely on himself and his own power." Is that a pretty good summary?
I think that's a very good definition. I would add other things as well to that definition.
And I'm going
to
let you as we go along, so don't worry about that. But let me come. You know, as I've been reading Sartre and Nietzsche and so on, each one of them, in their atheism, okay, there was a point in their life, and I'm going to ask that you would be kind of open and personal with in terms of these men, like Nietzsche and Sartre and so on, in their life, there was a time when they crossed over the line and they left God out of their life and they became an atheist. Let me ask you point blank. Are you an atheist?
I can prefer to call myself a skeptic. I'm an unbeliever. I've examined the arguments all during my life as a philosophy professor for the existence of God, all the evidence. I can find insufficient support. That's why I'm a skeptic. I don't know whether or not God exists. I cannot find sufficient reasons to believe in God.
So you'd be an agnostic.
I like the term skeptic. I'm not unwilling to say that I'm an atheist. That may shock some of the people here, but I'm not unwilling to say that. But a more sophisticated position is, as a skeptic, namely, I'm open-minded, I'm seeking and looking for the truth,
right,
and I don't find sufficient support for the claim that God exists.
Right. You know, there's two kinds of agnostics. There's the ornery agnostic and the ordinary agnostic. You know what the difference is on that one, don't you, Paul?
No, what is the difference?
Yeah. Ornery agnostic says, I don't know, but I know you don't know either. And you're not one of those, are you?
No, I consider myself an extraordinary.
Okay, but the ordinary agnostic simply says, I don't know, but if you got some evidence, I want to look for it. I want to see, I want to test it. And I think that's where you're coming from.
Yes.
That's why I enjoy the friendship here. As a philosophy professor, though, you also know that when you're talking about unbelief, it's philosophically impossible to prove a universal negative, namely, there is no God. I mean, it's a crummy position when you try to prove it. Another way of saying that would be, for our people that are listening in, is that if you got product A and product B over here, and you got two salesmen that are going at it, okay? Salesman A can knock down product B and all that it's for, and he can do a terrific job, knock the ball over the fence, and nobody will buy his product because he hasn't said a word about why you ought to buy his product. All he's done is torn down the other case. Okay? Before we start talking about Christianity and Orthodox Christian belief, tell me, what is it that you do believe and the proof for it?
Let me say first that if my little daughter asks me, does Santa Claus believe, maybe I can't disprove it. We can go to the North Pole and she can say, Daddy, he's in the South Pole. And we go down there and maybe somewhere else. So it's difficult to prove the negative, as you point out. On the other hand, I don't accept the existence of Santa Claus, except in a kind of mythological framework. I have no objection to the myth or the fairy tale. If Santa Claus exists, I want evidence for it. Okay, I'm a secular humanist. I believe in the human potentiality. I believe that we ought to develop a good life here and now, that we ought to use our best intelligence try to solve human problems, to build a good society, and to do what we can to alleviate human suffering. For me, the end of a good life is creative enjoyment, creative fulfillment, shared experience with other people in a good society.
Okay. I appreciate that thought, but if I was to come back and ask for more proof and say, if you were to talk to our audience and Dr. Geisler sitting there next to you, if somebody were to say this statement, it's in a book that I read, that atheism is false for several reasons. Number one, it's philosophically inadequate, scientifically erroneous, morally bankrupt, socially destructive, aesthetically impotent, and humanly degrading. Start with number one. Give me the philosophical evidence why you would say you hold on to naturalism, because you got to hold on to naturalism if there is no God, right?
Well, atheism means, I prefer the term non-theism, because I don't think the notion of a theistic being, that God is a person, I don't think that's entirely intelligible. In one sense, it's a confused or a meaningless concept to talk about a transcendent being who exists. In any case, when you look for the support, you ask people why they believe, what are the evidence, what is the reason they seem to be insubstantial. So yes, I'm a naturalist. Namely, I believe there's a universe out there, and I want to understand it. And the methods that I will use are the methods of experience and reason, primarily based upon the sciences. So humanism, I think, is the best expression of modern science. It's the scientific outlook, using the rigorous methods of the scientific inquiry in order to test hypotheses about nature.
Okay. Dr. Geisler, you've been sitting there for a little bit. Let me get you in here. And that is, do you think that skepticism, atheism, is philosophically inadequate today concerning the scientific evidence and the view of the world?
Well, I agree with Paul that we need to be rational, we need to be scientific. But when I look at the scientific evidence, it leads to belief in God. For example, the Big Bang Theory, by three lines of converging evidence, the expanding universe, the radiation echo, and the second law of thermodynamics, all lead scientifically to prove that the universe had a beginning. Now, one of the fundamental rational laws of all thought, and Paul is a rationalist, he wants to be rational, that's why I enjoy dialoguing with him, is that every event, everything that comes to be, has a cause. Now, if the universe came to be, then it's only rational to conclude that the universe had a cause. Let me illustrate by a story of two men, an atheist and a theist, who went for a walk in the woods. They came on a translucent ball, a glass ball about 8 feet in diameter, and the theist said to the atheist, where'd it come from? He said, I don't know, but somebody must have put it here. It just didn't pop into existence out of nowhere. They both agreed. And the theist said, well, if the ball is 16 feet in diameter, does it still need a cause? Well, yeah, if little balls need causes, big ones need causes too. And he said, well, if the ball is as big as the whole world? The atheist paused and said, well, yeah, little ones need causes and big ones need causes, and really, big ones need causes too. Then he said, what if the ball is as big as the whole universe? The atheist said, of course it doesn't need a cause, it's just there. That's not rational.
What do you think, Paul?
Well, you said, Norman, that every event has a cause. You maintain that. Every event has a cause. Is that what you said?
That's exactly right. Everything
okay.
comes to be
right.
has a cause.
Then you say the universe has a cause, and I take it that you would say that God caused the universe. And my question then is, if every event has a cause, what caused God?
Well, see, you just confused the statement. Everything that comes to be has a cause. God didn't come to be, so he doesn't need a cause. Just as the atheist believes...
You contradicted your notion.
No, I didn't. Let me finish. Just as the atheist believes that the universe is eternal, often, and therefore didn't need a cause, if you can have an uncaused universe, we can have an uncaused God. God, what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander.
No, I don't know that the universe... I wouldn't say necessarily the universe is uncaused.
If it's caused, then there must have been a cause beyond it.
There are causes. Now, you have the Big Bang, the hypothesis in contemporary physics and cosmology, that takes us back only to a point, but what caused the matter at that time before it exploded? So that
the Big Bang hypothesis says that the very matter of the universe came into existence 10 to 20 billion years ago. That when you take it back to a point, you reach a time where you have no space, no time, and no matter. You have literally nothing.
Well, we cannot say.
Even agnostics, Robert Jastrow, in his book, God and the Astronomers, says that it came into existence out of nothing some billions of years ago. Now, if it came to be, and every event that comes to be needs a cause, then the universe needs a cause, too.
Well, I don't want to talk about the universe. You have many divergent lines of causality and many kind of events happening.
What's wrong
but
with the universe?
You're leaping beyond it.
No, what's wrong with the universe and talking about the whole... So, what Sagan calls the cosmos.
You have the cosmos,
was,
you, have many, things,
will
you
be.
Have many things happening in the cosmos. Physics only takes you up to a point. What happened before that point? Now, if everything has a cause,
well,
then God must have a cause.
That's your question. No, see?
But you make an exception to the point that everything has a cause.
It's not an exception.
You're only pushing your ignorance one back.
Oh, no, it isn't. You're missing the point. You're not listening to it. Everything that comes to be has a cause. That's the principle. The universe came to be, therefore the universe has a cause. Now, if God always existed, he didn't come to
be,
he doesn't need a cause.
I see. Well, you're defining the situation, you're assuming your case by definition.
Not at all.
Because you're defining, how do you know that God did not come to be? How do you know that?
We know that the universe came to be.
But how do you know that God did not come to be?
And we know that everything that comes to be had a cause.
How do you know that God did not come to be?
Because everything that comes to be has a cause. And if he caused the universe to come to be, he couldn't
by definition. You're defining.
Not
you're trying to define what you want to prove.
The law of
how do you know?
The law of rationality.
That's not
every,
rational. That's
everything
an assumption.
That comes, you don't believe that.
Well, how do you know it?
Okay. Let me.
It's a rational assumption.
Let's start out with a couple of things.
An irrational assumption.
Irrational assumption. Well, that he thinks have causes.
Well, let's.
Well,
wait,
how
wait,
do you
wait,
know
wait,
that God?
Robin Paul, hold it here. I want to ask one question. What is the evidence scientifically that the universe has not always been here? Start with.
Well, I don't know whether I really don't. I said I was a skeptic. I don't know whether the universe was here, was or was not here, you say. I don't know that it came into being at a certain point. It seems to me you're leaping beyond the evidence.
I can take that, Paul, but let me ask you this. It seems like that you're always pushing the Christians in your magazine rationally and on the scientific evidence. Let me do the same to you, okay? And that is, what do you do with the scientific evidence of the second law of thermodynamics in relationship to what is here?
Well, it doesn't say anything about beyond the range of observation, and now you're leaping beyond the range of observation. You're only pushing your ignorance back one step. You have the universe, you want to explain it, and so you introduce an unintelligible, inexplicable being, a divine being, to explain it. That only...
You missed my point, too. All I said is that it seems like if we're scientific, we're working with what is observational and repeatable. We can't do that, so we have to work with what we do have here.
Yes.
Okay? What we do have here are heat laws. We do have energy laws.
Yes.
Okay? We do have that.
Yes.
Okay? Using just what I do have. Not what you don't know, but what I do have. Let's be rational on that. What conclusion would you come to?
You're jumping beyond what you have. You're jumping beyond the laws of physics
beyond
observation, and you're postulating an unintelligible, unknown being who you said always existed and did not come into being.
Let's not postulate anything about unknown being. Let's just take the logical conclusion that the second law of thermodynamics brings us to, namely that the universe had to have a beginning.
I don't see where that necessarily happens.
Well, it most certainly does.
And
had
to have a beginning.
Agnostic
or
atheist.
An end.
Okay, let's let Norman explain
that.
Why. Norman,
in his book, Five Ways, the British atheist Anthony Kinney says, the Big Bang Theory holds that the universe came into existence. So, as the atheist, he said, I'd have to conclude that the universe came into existence from nothing and by nothing. Now, you're talking about ultimate irrationality. They used to criticize us as theists for believing that someone made something out of nothing, ex nihilo creation, and left. Now, they believe no one made something out of nothing.
Aha!
Well, I deny the notion that the universe came into being ex nihilo, out of nothing. You're leaping beyond
then
the evidence.
Then it's eternal. Then you have something that's not
seems
caused.
To me it's,
what you just told me a moment ago is irrational, believe that something is uncaused like God.
No, it seems to me that
it's not any less
intelligible to say that
why
the universe
is irrational for you to believe the universe is uncaused, and irrational for me to believe that God is uncaused.
You think you're explaining what's happening in the universe, but you're not explaining it. You're reading an item of faith. I say as a skeptic, let's examine physics. Now, in physics, the Big Bang Theory makes sense. You're going far beyond physics. You're introducing something. You're introducing an intelligent being who has created the universe. This is unobservable. You've not tested it.
All right, let me slow it down here. So you're saying that the universe does have a beginning via the Big Bang and second law of thermodynamics, but you will say you don't know what caused it. And when Geisler says that God caused it, okay, now we have to simply say we weren't there. We can't say we all can check it out and scientifically repeat it. So number one is both theories, okay, are not factual in the sense that we can go back there and scientifically repeat it. So anybody that says that evolution is a fact, we've got to throw that out.
No,
right
that's
away.
Something else. That doesn't follow. You sneak that in. Evolution is quite independent. Quite independent of this point, you say. I don't know that the universe has a beginning. All I am saying, and I think all that we can say, is that in contemporary physics, the Big Bang Theory is a useful hypothesis. But you're going far beyond that. You're bringing in theology. You're going beyond science.
Well, I didn't think I brought anything in except the scientific laws and drew a conclusion.
Well, It's a conclusion that I questioned the conclusion.
On what basis scientifically do you question that conclusion?
I question the notion. When you talk about a cause, you talk about certain antecedent conditions that you can observe. And then you test the hypothesis. But when you talk about God as being the cause...
Okay, I didn't say anything about God yet. Okay, Norman's been saying that.
God, the cause of the universe.
Yeah, but I just want to get to this one point, Paul, and that is that it seems awfully interesting to me that using just science, okay, the second law of thermodynamics, which says that the universe had to have a beginning because if it was eternal, it would have already run down and we'd all be sitting here in an icebox, okay?
Well, it's not, obviously, so
it had to have a beginning apparently recently. Now, that's there. I haven't stuffed God
recently,
at all. All we have to do is say,
John,
now, what cause are we talking about for that? You're saying you don't know.
John, how recent are you talking about? What are you talking about? How recent?
I'm not talking about anything. I'm simply coming to that
10,
conclusion.
Years?
No, I'm just taking a conclusion.
Years?
10 to 20 billion years.
10 to 20 billion
okay,
years.
Okay, so the conclusion is it had to have a start, right? You'd agree to that?
I don't agree to the notion of start or a beginning, because what went before that, I don't know.
You don't know, but the conclusion with the evidence that you do know would suggest that it started.
No, I'm not going to say probably it started.
You don't say the second law of thermodynamics is good
explosion.
Evidence, Paul, for that?
The evidence suggests that there was an explosion and that there's a rapid moving away from the center. You can see this through the spectroscopic analysis of the shift towards red as the astronomers look at the heavens. And so 15 to 20 billion years later, we're talking about a process of evolution which follows from that.
All right. I got a couple of minutes here. We got to wrap this up. Norman, what would you postulate from the scientific evidence? And then Paul will let you respond, and Norman will come back to you here for a final word. But where are you going with the scientific evidence and what we're saying here?
It's very simple. I'm just using two principles. One is a fundamental rational principle that's the basis of all modern science. Every event, everything that comes to be, has a cause. The universe came to be, therefore the universe had a cause. And the evidence that the universe came to be is the second law of thermodynamics. It's running out of usable energy. Therefore, it can't be eternal or it would have run down a long time ago. Therefore, the universe must have had a beginning. That's a scientific fact. And if secular humanists want to be scientific, they have to face the facts. And the facts are that the universe had a beginning. If it had a beginning, there must have been a beginner. We can speculate later as to what kind of beginner, what kind of cause it was, but there had to be a cause. Otherwise, they're left with the absurd position that nothing produced something. And that is absurd.
Now, is that so irrational, Paul, what he just said?
Yes, I think it is. Mm-hmm. I think in the first place, he's introduced the notion that there had to be a beginner, you say. I deny that there was necessarily a beginning. But the notion that there had a beginner is to read in some anthropomorphic or anthropocentric notion of someone who begins the universe, some person.
Okay, Paul, let me just get the question right. What would you call the fact of a full stop, and the evidence suggests that, what would you call it?
Well, as I said at the earlier point, I was a skeptic about the origins of the universe. That was my first point. I don't think we have sufficient evidence to say. And this is merely conjecture and merely guesswork, and it's not scientific. It's merely a theological hope.
Why do all the scientists, even skeptics, atheists and agnostics, believe that the universe had a beginning? Even Paul Davies is talking about the universe coming into existence out of nothing, without a cause, and Anthony Kinney and Robert Jastrow, and all the scientists, they're not disputing that the universe had a beginning. All the evidence points it. They may dispute whether there's a God who caused it, but I think you're not looking at the evidence when you say the universe didn't have a beginning, because there's firm evidence that it did.
Physicists are uncertain at that point.
Okay. What impressive scientific evidence, according to the Humanist Manifesto, you've got all this, supports your secular humanistic view that first life came from non-life by accident, by chance. How did first life originate on Earth?
Well, you know, this is not simply a secular humanist viewpoint. The theory of evolution is so well supported by various sciences. In fact, I think it's one of the key principles of the whole of modern science. Let alone biology, genetics, paleontology, anthropology, geology and astronomy presuppose it. We have a notion that the universe is changing and evolving over a long period of time, and we can see this everywhere. And this is confirmed by converging evidence from many sciences.
Okay, how did first life, according to scientific evidence, originate here on Earth? Give me the evidence that you...
Well, there are different theories about that. Organic matter probably exists in other parts of the universe, not only on this planet. One hypothesis is that certain conditions of hydrogen in the atmosphere, many years ago there was a primordial soup, and that gradually organic matter evolved in the forms that it took on this planet. This is going back approximately 3 billion years.
Is that the hypothesis you want to work with?
That's a hypothesis that seems, in the light of present evidence, to best fit the
facts. How many hypotheses are out there, Paul?
Science has many hypotheses. The notion of science is that you have a hypothesis, you try to support it by the evidence, and there may be new hypotheses introduced, you constantly revise it. The fact of evolution seems to be very well supported by the sciences today. How it happened, precisely, is constantly changing.
But how can you have a fact you don't know how it happened?
There are many things that we don't know how it happened.
But why call it
that's
fact?
No problem. That's no problem.
Now, Christian's wrong when we say that, you know, you sound awfully impressive in the manifestos. You know, it's like, you know, you guys got it wrapped up, and we just need to check you out here, and you can let us in on the scoop of what the evidence really is. It is nonetheless supported impressively. Okay, I thought you had some impressive information there, and it's supported so strongly by the weight of evidence, it's difficult to reject it. Now,
well,
you've got to put
the evidence
hypothesis.
The evidence, all right, the evidence is that you find in the geological strata various fossils over a period of time. And you can see changes in species and the extinction of some species.
You're talking about transitional forms ought to be there.
What's that?
You're saying that Darwin postulated from, you know, smaller to more complex, and we're going to have all these transitional forms there, and the fossil record shows that conclusion. Is that correct?
The fossil record is not entirely complete, but what you find is...
How complete is it, Paul?
It is complete enough to support the hypothesis that there is evolution and change going on over a period of time. And you can see, for example, the extinction of some species that have disappeared, that no longer exist, and the emergence of new species. Now, evolution occurs in two ways. One is gradualism, and the other is punctuated equilibria. In other words, there are sudden spurts in history at the same time.
Okay, let's come to Norman. We got those two on the board, Norman. First life, as well as the fact of the fossil record. And let me throw in here, Dr. Paul Lemoyne, a French scholar and editor of the French Encyclopedia, states, evolution is a fairy tale for adults. Why would he say that, Norman?
Well, I don't know, but I'm tempted to say because he just listened to what Paul Kurtz said. I was listening for this impressive evidence. I didn't hear a shred of evidence, let alone impressive evidence. I heard a couple of hypotheses suggested. Let me quote an evolution. Haldane, in his book, said that this theory of hot dilute soup has been in the textbooks for over 30 years without a shred of geological evidence that it ever existed. That's an evolutionist. I commend to you attention a recent book written by three scientists entitled The Mystery of Life's Origin, where they totally destroy the credibility of the spontaneous generation view. And even Fred Hoyle, whom he knows very well, a former atheist who started to figure out what would the chances be of life evolving on Earth by pure chance or coming from outer space, and he concluded that the chances for a single cell animal evolving on Earth would be 1 in 10 to the 40,000th power. That's more atoms than there are in the whole universe. So the former atheist Fred Hoyle concluded there must have been an intelligent creator of first life, and his colleague Rick Ramasinghe said, believing that life came by chance is like believing that Boeing 747 resulted from a tornado going through a junkyard. You have to have a lot of faith to believe that.
Well, the Boeing 747 evolved. We can go back and see the Wright brothers, that first kind of airplane that they created in a period of time. There's
created.
An evolution, yes, that they invented.
By intelligence or by
chance? But there's a period of time in which these forms
changed. But didn't they create those airplanes via intelligence, or did they
I was using the analogy that he was doing. He was
well, you're helping my argument.
Well, no, what I used
to not that one.
No.
Find another one.
No, that's a meaningful... Essentially, the point I made is a good point, because there has been a change in airplanes from the simplest to the more complex. But are you denying the existence... Norman Geisler, are you denying the existence of evolution? Is this what you're saying?
I'm saying there's not a shred of evidence for macroevolution. Not only is there no impressive evidence, there's not a shred of evidence for macroevolution.
Well,
how about that for
well, then what do you do with paleontology, geology, anthropology, all the sciences, which have found different forms of life through different periods of time, and you can reconstruct a kind of line of development?
But Paul, I'm sure you're familiar with your buddies like Gould at Harvard and all these guys. I mean, why are they changing their theories? They don't buy that anymore.
The change of a theory is to the credit of science. Science is not absolute. It's not fixed. It's not final. It's an open method of investigation.
But they went away from what you're talking about, is what I'm saying.
Well, you have both processes happening at the same time. You have chance mutations which occur in certain species, and these are adaptable. And that then, by means of natural selection and by differential reproduction, this mutation, because it is adaptable, is passed down to other members of the same species, and so there is a change in the species.
Oh, you're so lovable. I tell you, put my arms right around you, but I tell you, I've got to say that.
Well, John, you're lovable too, but are you rejecting evolution?
In a big time way, because I'm reading
really?
Your buddies. Yes, sir.
I say. Well, let's leave love aside and let's deal with the evidence.
Let's deal with the evidence. Let me tell you about Gould of Harvard, for example, one of the head paleontologists in America. I met him at the Arkansas trial. He says there is no evidence for the so-called missing links. All you have really are the leaves on the tree. The tree is drawn by the evolutionists. The tree doesn't exist out there in nature. The head paleontologist of British Museum, Dr. Colin Patterson, whom I talked to not too long ago, gave a speech here in November 1981 to the top scientists in America. He said not only is evolution no knowledge, it is anti-knowledge. And I've worked on this stuff 18 years and know nothing from it. And he concluded the missing links are not only missing, they never were there, and they will never be found. And he said, if I knew of any, I would have put them in my book because I'm an evolutionist, but he admits that they aren't there. Now, what the evidence shows is that new forms of life come into existence suddenly, in complete functional form, and disappear suddenly. That looks like creation to me, not evolution.
Yeah, some of those things are what? Walruses, sea lions, bats. You know, those are just a few that, from what I've read in the paleontology books, is all of a sudden, voila, they're there, and they go all the way back, and they're the same way, all the way back.
Are you suggesting that God intervenes in history and creates these species and then destroys them? Is this your point?
No, my point is that God intervenes in history and creates them.
And destroys them, too?
No, he doesn't destroy them.
So who destroyed the dinosaur?
The dinosaurs were destroyed at the flood. Did you ever hear about the book of Genesis and when Noah took all these animals in the ark?
I heard about it, but I'm
flood.
Shocked that you believe in it, actually.
Well, maybe I should know better. You shouldn't be shocked to believe in it. The Bible.
The dinosaurs were destroyed 10,000 years ago?
The dinosaurs, we didn't say that the universe was only 10,000. You
okay.
just said
when
that.
When did the flood occur?
I don't know when the flood
well,
occurred.
I thought you were quoting the Bible.
The Bible doesn't say when the
okay.
flood occurred.
Can you give a suggestion of when it occurred?
I most certainly can give
yes,
a suggestion.
About how long ago?
It occurred in the book of Genesis. Genesis chapter 6, 7, and 8.
Okay.
And the record there is historical.
Well.
And for that matter, we know that because the Ebla tablets that have recently been discovered give us time periods back into the first 11 chapters of Genesis where these are historical events. They name city and places. This is not myth. This is history that's recorded.
It's a historical myth, but or
not
mythological
a historical
history,
myth
but,
either.
Okay, but did the flood occur 10 million years ago?
Doesn't matter when it occurred.
Well, can you give me some time
scale? The point is this, that God intervened in history. You asked me, did he intervene? Yes, we know because when things come into existence, they're fully formed. Yes, we know because they're fully functioning. The first bird had feathers and could fly. It didn't come with half feathers or scales on it. It was fully formed feathers and could fly.
Can I jump in here at the evolution creation trial? There was a guy that I think showed up from one of the laboratories and talked about polonium halos that has a bearing on the flood here. Maybe you could bring us up to date on what that was.
Yes, they never answered that. Dr. Robert Gentry talked about polonium halos, which are half-life halos, and they exist in bedrock, granite, and coal all over the world. They're daughter halos, and all of the basic granite would have had to come into existence in less than 3.5 minutes because they're 3.5 minute half-life. No one has ever even attempted to refute that.
You know, there are species that have been extinct within our own lifetime, and I just want to ask you, were all these species that extinct, were they extinct at the time of the flood? What about the saber-toothed tiger?
We're not talking about polonium halos. Can you refute the argument that Robert Gentry gave?
Which is? Which argument now?
The argument about the polonium halos, which have a half-life of 3.5 minutes and on our bedrock, granite, and coal all over the world, and therefore they would have had to have come into existence in less than 3.5 minutes.
I've not investigated that question, so I will reserve judgment about it. But I'm surprised that you say that the dinosaur was not extinct 20, 30 million years ago, but more recently, where all the scientific evidence suggests that there was a meteor shower, as one hypothesis, and that there was insufficient food on the planet, and this was the reason for the extinction of the dinosaur.
All the
has
scientific
to do with the
evidence
flood.
Suggests is one hypothesis. You contradict yourself in one sentence there. If all the scientific evidence suggests it, it's not one hypothesis.
Well, but to claim that the dinosaurs were killed by a flood is completely unsupportable by any evidence at all.
They were killed by a meteor shower all over the world, yes. And everything else didn't die too is also completely unsupportable.
It's not completely unsupportable because at least you have a range of testable evidence in the sciences where you're drawing simply upon the Bible, which is based upon faith. Now, if you maintain
the Bible is not based on faith, it's based on fact.
If you maintain there was a Noachian flood, and if the flood had to be as
high as Mount Ararat, then it is estimated there would have had to have been 3 miles of water to cover the Earth. That the water had to be as deep all over the world, number one. You're assuming that Mount Ararat is the same height, number two, and you're assuming that there isn't that water available, number three. All those are assumptions.
Well, but if the whole, according to the Bible, the whole Earth was covered by water, then you would have to cover the highest mountain peak, and you would have to have an awful lot of water to do so.
Even the water in this glass peaks. You can have water 2 miles deep here, and just a little over there could be 1 mile deep, and it could still cover the whole Earth. All it says is it covered Mount Ararat by that height. It didn't say that everywhere in the world, every mountain that now exists at its present height was covered by that distance. You're adding to the Bible in order to refute the Bible. That's a straw man.
In order to kill all of life on the planet, you would have to cover all portions of the planet. You maintain that the flood was not universal and did not cover the whole planet.
No, I maintain the flood was universal.
And covered the whole planet.
And kill everybody except 8 people. And all of the animals that Noah brought in,
all of the million species that he brought into the
not ark. A million species that he
That's
brought
right,
into
there are
the
million species.
Yes,
today.
But species is an artificial category that scientists created. It's not a natural category. The kinds of genesis are not to be equated with the species.
Well, you have wide diversity of species on the earth at the present, and presumably they were saved. In the ark, the ark would have to be awful large in order to contain all the
species. It's been proven that the ark is large enough to contain all the thousands of kinds of animals that there are.
Well, that is highly questionable. Not only contain the animals, but the food. Who would clean the manure, for example, in Noah's ark?
It's not highly questionable. It is mathematically provable. All you have to do is get your calculator out, figure the thousands of animals there were, figure the size of the ark, and there's plenty of room for all of them. Noah had a ventilating system in the ark. It even indicates it. There in Genesis, and the manure was good fertilizer after he got out.
All right,
But he had trouble walking through it.
Norman, I want to move on to another question, but we do want to talk about what do you have to say concerning first life here? What's the scientific evidence as far as you're concerned concerning first life?
The scientific evidence of first life is very strong. Dr. Yaki, in the Journal of Theoretical Biology, 1981, wrote an article where he showed that the new information theory discovered by Bell Laboratories proves that there's a mathematical identity between the specified complexity you find in the DNA and the kind of information you find, let's say, in a dictionary or an encyclopedia. Now, the first living thing, a single-cell animal, has enough information that, if spelled out in English, would fill one volume of an encyclopedia. And to believe that that happened by an explosion in a printing shop, say, is irrational. To believe that an intelligent being can put that together is rational. Now, what I would like to suggest is there are two alternatives. Either non-intelligent force put all that specified complexity together, or an intelligent being. I'd like to see a shred of evidence in the present from Dr. Hertz, a shred of evidence to show that regularly, repeatedly, and science is built on regularity and repeatability, that non-intelligent forces can produce specified complexity as great as a dictionary.
Well, encyclopedia is created by human beings, so the analogy doesn't follow. You have various forms of being in the universe with various degrees of complexity. I don't see where you have to invoke some mystical, hidden, occult, intelligent being in order to explain it. Take nature as you find it, with all of the complexities. And you describe it. And
I am taking nature as
best as
I find
you can,
it,
and then without I'm reading in something
reality of it. Questions: what caused this?
I said earlier I was a skeptic. I don't know the causes of everything. If I don't know
the cause of anything,
yes. If I don't know the cause of something, I will suspend judgment. A cause is an effort at irregularity. A cause is an effort at an explanation.
If you saw Mount Rushmore, would you assume, even if you'd never seen, that it had an intelligent cause?
Because I know people have used a chisel in order to chisel.
But just looking at Mount Rushmore and seeing those faces, you would assume an intelligent cause of that.
Of course.
Okay.
Because I've seen the intelligent being created.
There is more specified complexity and intelligent information in the first DNA than there is on Mount Rushmore. Why won't you assume an intelligent cause of that?
Because here's an analogy that you're reading into nature, because I can see the sculptor create Mount Rushmore, but I have not seen any sculptor.
But you didn't see the sculptor create Mount Rushmore. All you see is Mount Rushmore, and you assume an intelligent cause.
Because as a matter of fact, I did see it, so that's a bad analogy, and you did too. But we know about human culture. We know human beings create statues. All right, so this is something we observe. But you're going far beyond the observation.
That's the
point.
And
you're not taking nature as you find it.
No, I am taking
it.
I'm taking
which
nature
we are
exactly
apart.
As I find it. And I'm observing that whenever you have stratified complexity, complex information, it always had an intelligent cause.
No, that doesn't necessarily follow. That doesn't
follow.
Well,
let me finish. Do you know of any cases where you have a regular production of complex information, such as a Mount Rushmore or DNA, where a non-intelligent force produces
it? Yes, throughout nature, constantly.
Never.
Yes,
never.
In physics and in physics and biology and anthropology and over there. You have complexity. You have regularity. You have nature taking on order. You don't have to read in
the already there.
And we
chart it
back
to the beginning. How did the
you don't have to trace it back to the beginning.
But see, that's just reduplicating.
What you
find. Just a Xerox machine.
You formulate. You formulate causal hypotheses, and you explain these. You make predictions.
All you're saying is that, look, I have this page, and this page shows intelligent information, and I make a Xerox copy of it, a Xerox copy, and so that proves that there was no intelligence to produce the first page.
The page was produced by human beings. There's no problem here.
By an intelligent being, right?
By human beings, okay. But you have degrees of complexity in other parts of nature, and there's no evidence that they were produced by human beings or by God. You're reading
every time you get specified complexity, there's always an intelligent being. If over and over, David Hume said that constant conjunction is the basis for rational conclusions. You see cause and effect connected over and over, and you assume a connection. If over and over and over again, every time you blow a fan on alphabet soup, you get a mess. If every time you drop a bomb in a printing shop, you get a mess. But then you see a dictionary, or you see spelled out with alphabet soup on the table, I love you, sign Mary. What do you always assume rationally? An intelligent cause.
I don't assume that. You do.
You don't
I find
assume,
regularity.
You
I
don't
find
assume that?
Yes, I
you
find
you,
regularity.
If you came to your breakfast table and said, I love you, okay. Paul Kurtz, signed, your wife, you wouldn't assume an intelligent being did that?
Yes, in the human context.
Oh,
in the human context. But you're going beyond that.
Well, of course.
I find regularities in nature, and one doesn't necessarily mean that there's an architect.
Well, why would you assume
an intelligent
being did
that?
We got to move on here. All right, we're into the discussion in the Secular Humanist Declaration that the first principle of democratic secular humanism is its commitment to free inquiry. We all clap on that one. You say, we oppose any tyranny over the mind of man. Okay? That's arbitrary power, exercise of power. And free inquiry requires that we tolerate diversity of opinion. We all like that. And then we respect the rights of individuals to express their beliefs, however unpopular they may be, without social or legal prohibition. And then I find a little inconsistency, Paul, here in the Declaration, because a few pages over, after you said those beautiful words...
Yes, they were beautiful, weren't they?
But despite this statement, you say, this is the same Declaration, a couple pages over, you reject the teaching of scientific facts that support creationism by this statement. We deplore the efforts of fundamentalists, especially in the United States, to invade the science classrooms, requiring that creationist theory be taught to students and requiring that it be included in biology textbooks. This is a serious threat both to academic freedom and to the integrity of the educational process. Now, haven't you violated your own humanist principles where you just talk so beautifully about an open, free diversity of opinion, we can't put laws on people, and all of a sudden you turn around a couple pages later and you say, but we don't want any of those fundamentalists bringing up some of those facts that Geisler was talking about last week.
No, I don't find a contradiction on that point, John. I think that the integrity of science, the freedom of scientific research is vital. This country is based upon science. I think that I have no objection to creationist theories being taught in history of ideas courses or history courses or sociology courses in schools. But to impose them by political or legislative means on science teachers in the science classrooms, and to insist that this biblical theory be taught side by side with a scientific theory, it seems to violate the most basic principle of science. And there has been this battle between religion and science going back to Galileo, in which there have been great martyrs in the history of scientific thought. If scientific theorists, if science itself, if biologists themselves believe that the creationist theories were useful, then by all means they should be taught.
But how would a guy like Wickramasinghe, that's a Buddhist, you know, slide his theories in sideways if you can't say anything about the fact it may lead to creation?
Well, Wickramasinghe is an astronomer, is he not? And he argues that, and it's an interesting hypothesis,
what I want to know,
that organic beings may come from meteors from outer space on the planet Earth, yes.
Would you let him argue it, is what I'm saying. You're saying no.
Well, I'm saying, well, I think the point is that there's been demand for equal time, and that sounds fine.
I think it is fine, isn't
okay,
it?
Okay. Now, astrology, you take astrology, there are more astrologers in the United States than astronomers. I think something like 29% of the people in the United States believe in astrology. Now,
in
should
France,
astrology be taught in astronomy, compelled to be taught in astronomy courses? It seems to me the answer is no.
But the fact is that
you undermine the whole basis of astronomy. And I think that our children need the best education that they can get, and you're undermining the basis of biology and genetics by insisting by political power that this be taught in biology courses.
Before I answer that, I'm not the guest here. Geisler, why don't you get in here and say something about that?
Well, Paul, bless his heart, just blew a lot of smoke in your face. What he said wasn't true. It was all straw men. First of all, we're not requiring the biblical view. It explicitly states in the Arkansas law that no biblical view can be taught. We're requiring science be taught, scientific evidence for origins. Secondly, it was not equal time. That's already been ruled out by law. It was balanced treatment, not equal time. Equal time would be practically impossible. And thirdly, we're not trying to impose our views on him. It's the evolutionists that are trying to impose their view. In 1925, at the first Scopes trial, Clarence Darrow, the ACLU criminal lawyer who defended the evolutionist view, said, quote, "It is bigotry for public schools to teach only one theory of origin." In 1981 at Arkansas, and I was a witness there, the same ACLU argued it's bigotry for public schools to teach two theories of origin. Now, I came to a conclusion. Bigotry hasn't changed, just the bigots have.
Well, but you're assuming that the creationist theory is a scientific theory, whereas biologists deny that. That's a biblical theory. You appeal to the Bible. When an issue comes up about when were dinosaurs extinct, you say the Noachian flood supports that. So you're really using the Bible, and you're saying that this is scientific. This is merely a mask. Creationism is merely a mask for a religious doctrine. And what you have is a very basic notion of scientific freedom at stake in this country.
But Paul, you and I both have PhDs in philosophy. We both taught philosophy. I've taught logic. You've taught logic. What you just said was a classic case of special pleading. You said biologists don't consider it science. Evolutionary biologists don't consider it science, but creationist biologists do. You just engaged in special pleading.
Not at all. In fact, you're an expert at special pleading, and perhaps I was taking an example from you.
Give me an
because,
example.
I mean, if it were the case that the scientific biology journals thought that creationism was a useful hypothesis in explaining the fossils that we find on the planet Earth, that would be another matter. But the biologists throughout the country, throughout the world, reject this notion.
Creationist biologists throughout
the country. There are very few creationist biologists. There are very few mainline biologists. There are very few. There are tens and tens of thousands of biologists.
Oh, so we decide by majority vote.
You have certain standards of scientific investigation, and if anyone with any point of view wants to impose it upon a science, this is a laughing stock of a scientific
inquiry. That a minority point of view cannot be taught. Because I hold the majority point of view is sheer bigotry.
That's
humanists,
tyranny,
in my opinion, are bigots because they want only their view to be taught in the public schools. And I think the fundamentalists in 1925 were bigots because they wanted only their view. But I think you humanists in 1985 are equally bigots because you want only your view taught.
On the contrary, I don't think it involves bigotry at all. I think what it involves is the very basis of the scientific method or scientific inquiry.
Right.
Because any dissident... You say that any dissident minority in any field can determine by using political power and the power of the state that certain textbooks should be used even if the people who teach those courses are opposed
to
that.
Political power is in the hands of the evolutionists.
All right, let me jump in here, guys.
We ought to protect minority rights so that political power can't squash
them. Let me jump in here, okay, and keep us going. Second, the humanists speak of a right to education. Again, going back to the Humanist Declaration, you state, "We believe that moral development should be cultivated in children and young adults. Hence, it is the duty of public education to deal with these values." Question is when you have people like John Dumphy, who says, "I am convinced," and he's a secular humanist, "that the battle for humankind's future must be waged and won in the public school classrooms by teachers who correctly perceive their role as the proselytizers of a new faith, a religion of humanity. The classroom must and will become an arena of conflict between the old and the new, the rotting corpse of Christianity together with all its adjacent..." evils and misery, and the new faith of humanism. It seems to me that some of the secular humanists are looking as the school classroom, the public school classroom, where we have millions of Christian parents who pay their taxes to support the schools and what is taught. They're looking at it like they're going to convert those kids to a belief that the parents don't want to be converted to.
You know, I think that is a libel against public school teachers. The quotation you read from John Dunphy was a student who entered a contest and they published an essay in the Humanist magazine. He does not speak for humanists, nor does he speak for educators in the country, and I disagree with him.
Okay, let me give you one
thought. On the other hand, I think moral education ought to be taught in the schools. I think it is being taught in the schools, and you can't have education without it. I think we want the best education for us. Students. I don't think that the educational process should be either pro or anti-religious, either way.
Okay, but isn't bigotry defined as one who obstinately or intolerantly is devoted to his own beliefs or opinions? And the Humanist Manifesto seems to be strictly against this. For example, you say, the preciousness and dignity of the individual person is a central humanist value. We reject all religious, ideological, or moral codes that denigrate the individual, suppress freedom. We believe in the cultivation of feeling and love. And to enhance freedom and dignity, the individual must experience a full range of civil liberties, including freedom of speech, the legal right of opposition to government policies, and religious liberty. We are committed to an open and democratic society. All persons should have a voice in developing the values and goals that determine their lives. Let me finish this up. One of the men that signed that statement was Paul Blanchard. You got it listed in the back of the book.
Yes.
Blanchard says, though, we have an obligation to expose and attack the world of religious miracles, magic, Bible worship, salvationism, heaven, hell, and all mythical deities. We should be particularly specific and energetic in attacking such quack millennialists as Billy Graham and such embattled reactionaries as the Pope, because they represent the two greatest anti-humanist aggregates in our society. So it seems like we've got a bigot in the group here, who says one thing in the manifesto and something else in society.
Paul Blanchard was a congregational minister. He endorsed the Humanist Manifesto, too, as did hundreds and indeed thousands of people. And surely I'm not going to defend everything that Paul Blanchard said. But he's not talking about the classroom on that point, is he?
He's talking about society as a whole.
He's talking about society as a whole. Oh, okay, about that, it seems to me that if Christians and Orthodox people have a right to their point of view, then skeptics and non-believers have a right to their point of view and a free market of ideas. We're not talking about the schools now. In a free market of ideas,
why not the schools?
Pro and anti-religious points of view ought to
contend. We always assumed that the schools were part of the free market.
Randall, but concerning the First Amendment of the Constitution, Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or the free exercise thereof. The schools are supposed to be neutral in regard to religion, pro or anti-religion.
But if secular humanism is a religion defined by the Supreme Court, then you're teaching your religion.
You accept everything the Supreme Court defines?
Or certainly don't, but they sure got
you
now.
Do you accept them on abortion, John?
No, I don't, but do you?
You don't. Okay, so don't quote the Supreme Court. I don't accept the Supreme Court on that point either. I don't think secular humanism is a religion.
I won't quote them. I'll quote the Humanist Manifesto 1. Okay? Humanist Manifesto 1 says that it is a religion. You and your own magazine, you have your own boys. 67,000 of the Unitarians say that it is a religion.
Well, the humanism is not a dogma. There are wide differences among there are as many humanist positions as there are humanists.
Paul Tillich's theological definition of a person that believes mean ultimate commitment. You don't have an ultimate commitment to secular humanists?
There are religious humanists. I'm a secular humanist myself.
But is that your ultimate commitment,
Paul? I don't think that humanism is a religion. I think it's a scientific, a philosophical, and an ethical position.
Now, the question is, should we let you teach your religion, or do we get a chance to at least get our views on the board, too?
I don't think that religion should be taught in the public schools. And I think the fact that one teaches modern literature, modern science, exposes children to a wide range of ideas is not teaching religion.
Dr. Geiser, what do you think?
Well, some humanists call themselves religious and some don't. But that doesn't take away from the fact that legally they're recognized as a religion and can get conscientious draft status from it, as the American Humanist Association did. Humanist Manifesto calls itself a religion. Humanist Manifesto 2 implies also that it's a religion. The Supreme Court recognized it was a religion. It's recognized by definition. I did my doctoral dissertation on this very topic. What is religion? It's a commitment to something. John Dewey, who signed that has enduring value. John Dewey, who signed the Humanist Manifesto 1, thought it was a religion. He wrote a book called The Common Faith. They're just simply copying out when they say it's not a religion, because it is a religion, it's recognized as a religion, and the premises of secular humanism can be taught in the public schools, but the premises of Christianity can't be. Now, I think we ought to be fair. If We're going to be pluralistic and open. We ought to be able to teach the premises of both. I could suddenly say, hey, what I believe as an Orthodox Christian isn't religious, and make the same kind of cop-out that he just did, and then say, it's because I said it wasn't religion, you can teach creation, you can pray, you can read the Bible in the public schools. He wouldn't buy that, and I don't buy what he said.
The Torcaso versus Watkins case in 1961. Mm-hmm. Torcaso was a justice of the peace. He did not want to swear on the Bible, and the Supreme Court said he did not. And it said that Buddhism, ethical culture, or secular humanism can function as a religion, and that the right of conscience of belief and non-belief ought to be respected. The Supreme Court did not define secular humanism as a religion by that footnote. But on the other point, I don't think that secular humanism as a religion is being taught in the schools. I think that is a libel against our millions of school teachers. I think what is being taught is modern literature, modern science, modern philosophy, the whole range of knowledge.
Well,
and our students should learn that.
Okay, let me back up and quote you. Okay, good source. Secular humanism or religion, an article that you had in the Free Inquiry. You quote Paul Tillich, and you say, he introduced the term ultimate concern to refer to this form of religiosity. And here he was referring to the human qualities of experiences and claimed that as religious Christians, Jews and Muslims, may be devoted to their religious faith or creed, so atheists, Marxists, and naturalists may have an equal devotion and dedication to theirs. This commitment may be called religious if it expresses one's whole response to life, to core attitudes and values. That's Paul Kurtz.
But you're quoting me out of context, John.
Read it,
I
right?
Then went on, out of context. I then went on to say, however, if one used religious in that way, then a vegetarian is religious. Anyone
no.
who's dedicated to
you
any
didn't have
field,
anybody speak back to you on that point.
Anyone who's dedicated to any field, then you can't teach anything in the schools. I mean, if you're devoted to literature with commitment, then it's religious. But that it seems to me to be nonsense.
Can I take you up on your logic at that point?
Yes.
If you're talking about a vegetarian, he can feel strongly about it and not be his ultimate commitment.
It could be his ultimate. You know vegetarians like I know vegetarians?
Yeah, it could be.
It could be his ultimate
if it is,
commitment.
Then it would apply, wouldn't it?
Well, then nothing. You see, anything that anyone feels strongly about as a religion, then nothing can be taught in the school.
Let me check on his point. I agree with Paul here. Let me tell you why. Because it's the same kind of illogic that they use on teaching creation. They say creation is believed by religious people, therefore creation shouldn't be taught in the public schools. Doesn't follow, does it? Just because a humanist believes in vegetarianism or a humanist believes in something else doesn't mean if you're teaching those, you're automatically teaching religion. Likewise, if you're teaching creationism, you're not automatically teaching religion either, and yet you called it a religion early on by the same kind of logic that you just tried to refute John with.
Well, I think your point on this point, let me meet you halfway on this. It's true.
You're going to back off?
No, I'm not going to back off. I'm going to move ahead. But
how do you, how do you go halfway without backing off?
What I'm going to say is that humanists believe in evolution, but so do other people, Christians and Jews. Most liberal Christians and Jews and others believe in evolution in our country, too. It's only a narrow fundamental or literalist interpretation or evangelical interpretation that there's not. But if you go through the whole gamut of what's taught in the schools, most people believe in science today. The fact that the humanists believe in science doesn't make science humanist or doesn't mean that everyone who teaches it is a humanist. But now, in regard to creationism, if I were convinced that creationism was a meaningful hypothesis in science today, then I would say, yes, it ought to be examined.
I do teach
creationism in my classes.
Let me convince
in
you.
Philosophy where it is appropriate, but it's not appropriate to force it on the biologists.
And let me tell you why it is. Number one, M.B. Foster in 1934 in Mind, the prestigious English philosophy journal started by G. Moore that you're familiar with, said that the origin of modern science is the doctrine of creation. Whitehead said that the concept of a creator was the origin of modern science. Yaki says it, Gilkey says every major historian of the philosophy of science agrees that the history of modern science would not have arisen without the doctrine of a creator and creation. Secondly, from 1620 to 1860, every one of the major scientists, with few exceptions, believed in a creator and creation. Now, you're telling me that what was the origin of modern science and that what scientists believed for 240 years, what thousands of scientists still believe today, isn't science. You're like the black ant on the anthill looking at the brown ant and saying, you're not an ant and that's not an anthill.
On the contrary, Norman, science began when the scientist rejected authority, when he rejected appeals to mere revelation, when he said that belief should be based upon evidence in the laboratory. Science can only begin when you move beyond faith. So it was when scientists moved beyond their purely religious commitment that the door was open to inquiry. Now, it's true that many scientists are believers, and many scientists are not believers. And it's true that historically, many scientists did believe in creation.
Okay. Okay,
well, we're going beyond that. We're talking about the 20th century, in which that's not a meaningful hypothesis in the life science.
You know, but I certainly liked the words that you had in the manifesto. I think you ought to just add a few of these paragraphs that you want freedom to teach your thought. And you don't want freedom for all thoughts. You want freedom to teach your thought. Let me give you a quote from Dr. Pierce at Harvard, who addressed 2,000 teachers in Denver and said this: "Every child in America who enters school at the age of 5 is mentally ill, because he comes to school with allegiance toward our elected officials, toward our founding fathers, toward our institutions, toward the preservation of this form of government, patriotism, nationalism, sovereignty. All of that proves that children are sick, because the truly well individual is one who has rejected all of those things and is what I would call the true international child of the future." Do you agree with that?
No, I don't agree with that.
I'm glad to hear that.
Surely you quote people. Do I agree with that? I don't know that. I don't know that. I've never heard of that man. I don't know that he's a humanist. I don't agree with that.
It seems like that it's in line with the humanist manifesto.
I do believe in freedom, and I believe in the open market of ideas, and I believe in the clash of ideas.
But also,
I don't want to impose, because of a long battle, I do not want to impose upon free scientific investigation.
Well,
I think that's what's happening
on people. The Gallup poll shows that almost two-thirds of Americans believe in creation. And the NBC poll in 1981 in November, just before the Arkansas trial, showed that 76% of Americans wanted both views to be taught. You're saying 76% of Americans want it taught, two-thirds of Americans believe in creation, the early scientists believed it was the basis for modern science, but I say, and my buddies say, it's not science, therefore you can't teach it. That's bigotry, let's face it, Paul.
It's not bigotry, Norman. You're interpreting it as bigotry.
Yeah, I need a 30-second statement from both of you. Paul, go ahead.
Well, I think that what is at issue is freedom of scientific research, the best education for our children, the effort to oppose any effort, the need to oppose any effort from outside the classroom or outside science to impose the doctrinaire dogma upon it.
Norman?
I agree with that 100%, except that he's inconsistent in that he's saying freedom of ideas as long as they're humanist ideas, freedom of ideas as long as they're evolutionist ideas, but if there's anything that opposes my humanism, evolution, sorry, you're not free.